Hi, I'm David Crowe, and this is episode 239 of The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. PRN.FM voicemail is 862-800-6805. Make sure you note that your message or question is for The Infectious Myth and leave your name. If you dial either of these numbers, long-distance charges may apply. Remember that I don't know your listener until I hear from you, and I sure do like to hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, important point, I'll send you a little thank you gift, one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from my listeners. Don't be shy. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, or commit to monthly donations at patreon.com or liberapay.com, where we are also Infectious Myth, one word. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on any topic you think I have an interesting and worthwhile opinion on, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Lynn Milliken obtained an RN diploma in 1977 from Faulkner Hospital School of Nursing, a nursing BS from UMass Boston in 1994, and a paralegal certificate from Northeastern U Boston in 1998. She took Lupron at age 32 for 9.5 months for treatment of endometriosis and during several IVF cycles between the years 1989 and 1991. She had worked full-time as the evening in-charge RN on an acute admitting psychiatric unit at the Veterans Administration until taking Lupron, but after experiencing adverse health effects, she was out of work for extended periods of time, and over the years gradually cut down from 40 hours a week to 16 before having to retire in 2003. She began researching Lupron's risks in the early 1990s and launched her website in 2008. She's been invited to testify on the risks of Lupron to congressional staffers and the President's Council on Bioethics in 2002 and the U.S. Congress in 2003. She's provided pro bono assistance to several Lupron victims, including those in the Paulson versus Abbott and AbbVie case and the Klein versus Tapp and Abbott cases. Because of her website, she's been contacted by and served as a resource for academics, physicians, attorneys, media, and Lupron victims and their families, and was responsible for prompting the first print media story on Lupron's risks in the Boston Globe in 1996, the first TV news story on Fox News in 1999, and the first internet investigation on Red Flags in 2002. Before Lupron, she was a healthy, vibrant individual who loved to hike and camp with regular cross-country trips, and camped in every U.S. state but two and throughout British Columbia. She built her own cabin in the remote woods of Maine, where she lived for years without running water or electricity. Now she is debilitated by chronic severe Lupron-induced bone pain, and when not sick from the frequent Lupron-induced gastroparesis episodes, it's still even difficult for her to get to the grocery store. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me and your insight.
So first, can you tell us what Lupron is? Because until probably a year ago, I'd never heard of this drug.
Well, David, you ask really the $64,000 question. I'm not exactly sure what Lupron is. It's classified as a GnRH analog, or gonadotropin hormone-releasing analog. It affects the brain. It suppresses your hormones, affects your gonads. I believe it affects every system in your body as a result of that action. It was first approved out of the FDA in 1985, not for prostate cancer, but it was not approved out of the Office of Oncology or the Office of Drugs. It was approved out of the Office of Biologics. And I've never really been able to understand why that is.
How is Lupron administered?
It is administered by injection, either a daily injection, which has sort of fallen out of favor, or a monthly injection. There's also 3-month injections, 4-month injections, and 6-month injections, depending upon your diagnosis. And approximately a year or so ago, there was an oral pill that was approved for endometriosis, Oralissa.
Well, we'll get into like some of the things that it's being used for. I don't know what it's it's approved for, but it's being used for a lot of things that you document quite well.
Right. It's only approved for palliative treatment of prostate cancer, endometriosis, precocious puberty, and I'm trying to think of how they word it, for the anemia associated with fibroids when iron therapy alone is ineffective.
Okay.
However, as you say, it's used off-label from A to Z. You name it, it's used for it.
So you took Lupron for 2 of those uses, for endometriosis and IVF. I mean, did you realize at the time that you were taking the same drug for those 2 things?
I was using the daily Lupron, and in 1989, there actually was no female approval. It had not been approved for endometriosis until 1990, and I did know that. I was told out of a world-renowned hospital that this drug was used throughout the world and that it was safe and effective, but that the FDA was slow. It just had not yet been approved for women. So that is the extent of what I knew, and the label that I was researching at the time pertained to men and prostate cancer. And I was really only told about hot flashes, minor things, nothing long-term at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then subsequently, when I underwent the IVF, I used the daily Lupron again.
Right. And did you have issues when you were taking it for endometriosis and not realize it was the Lupron, or did the issues not really start till you did IVF?
No, I was sick on the drug, and I complained. I had stomach problems. I couldn't sleep. In fact, I was in such a fog that I was put out of work on a disability, the first time in my entire career that had ever happened, because of the intensive effects of the medical therapy, quote unquote. And I just could not sleep, so I had perpetual insomnia. But
how would you compare, like you were taking it for endometriosis, how would you compare the symptoms of endometriosis to the side effects of Lupron?
Well, you know, the things that I wound up saying have been echoed by the millions, it seems. Far rather endure the pain of endometriosis than deal with the side effects of this drug. And that is something that endometriosis patients say all the time. They would go back and deal with their endo pain. And I certainly, my life was certainly impacted by endometriosis. However, I can say that despite that, I had a wonderful life, and I was able to live a good portion of the month in a normal fashion, and I felt healthy, and I was healthy. But that is no longer the case. And as each medical problem and diagnosis came up, I would say, you know, this has all just happened since Lupron. I was told there's no connection, it's just a coincidence. It's your time.
Time of the month.
My time to develop XYZ.
Oh, I see, because you're getting a little bit older, so you should expect to be getting all of these things. All right.
Right.
There's always an excuse. I mean, it seems almost universal amongst allopathic doctors, those that prescribe a lot of pharmaceutical drugs, that no matter what happens to you, it's not an issue. Like if you take antidepressants and you get worse, you'll be told, oh, well, you know, your symptoms will go away, or you're just imagining it, or whatever. They'll come up with some excuse to keep
right.
you
blame
on the drugs.
Not the drug.
Yes, yes, never blame the drug.
But I knew just simply because of the drastic change in my entire body that it had to be Lupron.
Right, right. So can you describe some of the major side effects that you've had and, you know, why didn't they go away? I mean, I guess you can't answer this, but, you know, you haven't taken Lupron for years. So which ones stuck around after after you quit?
You know, I mean, this is basically supposition on my part. I mean, you know, I certainly have done a lot of medical research into the drug, but I believe that it affects the pituitary, it affects your hormones. Therefore, there's such a cascading effect that all of these negative occurrences just build up. I guess you could use my alimentary system, my GI system, as a good example. On Lupron, I had nausea, vomiting.
Mm-hmm.
Then I developed gastritis. Then I developed an ulcer. I developed a gallbladder tumor, an atypical gallbladder tumor that was seen in interdepartmental review. Now I have, it progressed into gastroparesis, which is paralysis of the stomach and intestines. Now I have diverticular disease. You know, it started minimal and it just kept growing.
Well, some of the list of side effects that you have on your website, which has a tremendous amount of information, skeletomuscular problems, and I've read about a lot about these in terms of the girls taking Lupron for precocious puberty and now for gender dysphoria, that it causes tremendous skeletal problems. I guess
yes.
The joints and things like that.
Right. The bone pain is tremendous. I can remember on Lupron the extreme suffering, and I've only had a minimal experience with this specific symptom, but while I was on it, it was horrendous. It was as if your skin was removed, but your bone was in a vise, and the vise was just being cranked and cranked. It was awful. And what I was told was that is the menopausal effect. The drop in estrogen brings on the bone pain. Well, that just does not make physiological sense.
Menopausal women don't generally get severe bone pain.
Correct. And for women with endometriosis, the common phrase is, you will be in a temporary menopause. However, if you look at the hormonal profile of a woman on Lupron, it's low FSH, low LH, and allegedly low estrogen, although there's a lot of escape.
And these are the female hormones.
Correct. However, in a menopausal woman, she has high FSH. High LH and low estrogen. They just don't match.
Right, right.
So for them to even pawn that off as a scientific rationale is ludicrous.
Okay, some more side effects that you document on your website. Neurological, psychiatric, and a drop in IQ, all related to the nervous system, of course. So what are some of the major things that you or other people have experienced in this area?
Well, thankfully, in my own case, I have not experienced the mental health effects.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I don't know if I just have good genes or because of my career, I have coping skills, whatever. But the anger that I experienced at the change in my life and body motivated me to do the things that I've done. But I have heard just terrible stories of, including the children, precocious puberty, severe depression, suicidal, in institutions multiple times, or suicidal attempts, panic attacks, bipolar issues. And I don't know if you've seen on my website, but there's a section on Lupron and homicide, there is a woman who will be getting out of jail after serving 18 years for murdering her husband, shooting him in the head while he slept on Lupron, and I believe she was in a fugue state. She had no memory of it. A lot of women have talked about similar circumstances. They'll be driving, and suddenly they don't know where they are, and that actually did happen to me once in Florida. A lot of confusion, memory loss. Memory loss is a major one that, at least now, it is admitted and acknowledged, but in the past, it was just poo-pooed. However, medical documentation says that memory loss is commonly observed, even though at the time that was written, I think the FDA listed memory loss as number 23 in terms of rank.
Another neurological symptom is convulsions.
Yes. I've heard of a few. I don't really have personal experience with that, but I do know that it absolutely affects the brain. And there was a psychologist who had never heard of Lupron, and he had a woman who came in, and he did a 19-lead EEG, which I had never heard of before. But at any rate, he said he has never seen such a dysregulated EEG in his entire career. And as you mentioned, the drop in IQ has been reported amongst children with precocious puberty. And those studies, if you were to read them, there are statements in there that dismiss them. You know, not clinically relevant, or I'm not exactly recalling the exact verbatim, but they don't seem to take that to be serious. And that's, I think, very serious.
I think a lot of patients' symptoms that may be side effects of drugs are not taken seriously, and I think that's particularly true amongst women. I don't know if it's changed that much. Another thing I notice about this drug is, like, if you look at the number of years of life that are disrupted by the drug because the side effects seem to keep going on, obviously the younger the person, the more years of life are damaged or destroyed. And for like precocious puberty, I've heard that it's used to help girls gain height, which I'm kind of shocked about. And gender dysphoria, we're talking about teenagers in this case.
So, and even younger than teens.
Yes, that's true. Now gender dysphoria is being diagnosed in 2-year-olds, so goodness knows how young some children will be before they go on this drug. But I want to go through a few more side effects before we go on to other things. You also identified cardiovascular, diabetes, and weight gain as side effects.
Yes. There have been warnings placed in the male label for the cardiovascular effects, including stroke, sudden death, myocardial infarction. However, they do not have data on women or children. However, there have been a number of case reports of women having myocardial infarctions, heart attacks, and also irregular heartbeats, a lot of tachycardia. You know, the adverse events clearly show that cardiac problems are showing up in women, but there hasn't been any action taken on the part of the FDA. And I can't really address in terms of cardiac effects on the children because nothing is coming to mind.
I don't know how much study there's been, and this massive expansion of the use of GnRHA drugs for gender dysphoria is relatively recent, so it's probably too early to say. It's like a giant uncontrolled experiment.
Right, and you know, I really appreciate the physicians, the pediatric endocrinologists and others who have spoken out about the risks of this drug, specifically when we're talking about gender dysphoria. But I've noticed that there's often a comment that there's good data on the effects of children with precocious puberty.
Right.
But I have real concerns about that because from the emails that I get, clearly there are a lot of kids who took this drug who are permanently disabled and suffering continuously.
Well,
and I don't think you can say that everything's okay with Lupron and precocious puberty, because I just don't think that's so.
Well, the other sad thing about this is that precocious puberty is not a disease. It is a social problem. I actually was talking to a woman whose daughter had precocious puberty, I don't know, like 8 or something like that. And she managed it socially. So in other words, your daughter develops breasts and starts to look like a teenager when they're not. And of course, that attracts attention from boys who don't realize that
right.
they're dealing with a child. So that's, I mean, you have to manage that and make sure that, you know, your daughter isn't getting, you know, into trouble because she becomes sexually desirable to boys.
And those parents are in a very tough spot because there really is very little that can be done to treat precocious puberty.
Right. Well, I guess what I'm saying.
Two years old.
Oh wow. Well, that is. I mean, I guess there's times where it maybe is medically necessary, but I think in some cases it's just like you can either manage it socially. You could understand what's happening and understand that your daughter is in some kind of, you know, could be in danger if left alone with boys who might think she's much older than she is, or you can take a drug. But I mean, if the drug has lifelong health problems, I mean, I think I would go the non-drug route myself. But
however, the pediatric endocrinologists who are prescribing Lupron are nowhere near the realm of dealing with social treatment. Their goal is medical treatment.
Well,
it's not even discussed.
And how much do the parents know about the potential risks of this drug?
Well, I wrote a series of articles for Hormones Matter, and in the first one, I reproduced, I don't know, about a dozen or so of anonymized emails that I had received. And that is what most of these mothers say. I was told nothing, or I was told injection, redness at injection site, headache, nothing, and they literally are distraught.
Okay. Well, let
when
me
find my website.
Well, this is a classic example. So this is an October 29th, 2019 statement by the Pediatric Endocrine Society about puberty suppression once puberty has started. This is a reversible treatment that decreases the distress of having the wrong puberty. This treatment alone does not cause infertility. I mean, what do you think about that statement?
Well, you have a young teenager who is just developing their reproductive life, and you're going to smash it into oblivion and tell people that it's reversible and their fertility will not be affected. That should be criminal. There are women who have gone through normal puberty and wound up with endometriosis who, after Lupron, wound up infertile or subfertile. Or some type of ovarian function disorder. And nobody is really paying any attention. And I did find, it was in a label, Lupron Depot Ped label, where they mentioned that 20% of the follow-up did not get their menses. So by their own admission, 20% of those that were followed up evidenced some problem.
So not getting their menses, you mean they stopped menstruating?
Right, they did not menstruate.
And for the guys out there, if a woman doesn't menstruate, she's not going to get pregnant, right?
Correct.
There's a lot of people who don't quite understand how the female reproductive system works, sadly.
Right. Well, menstruation is usually the end result of an unsuccessful attempt at
right.
You know, the egg is produced, and if it's not fertilized, then it's shed.
Right. And so the only time when not menstruating is a happy event is when you're trying to get pregnant, because it's usually a sign
that... when you are pregnant.
Yes. Well, that's true. It stops for the whole time. Now, an important question. Some people who've talked to me about gender dysphoria have said that Lupron is not the most commonly used GnRHA drug for gender dysphoria. And the implication is, you know, maybe the side effects of Lupron are different. So do you know anything about what's being used for gender dysphoria? Is Lupron being used a lot? And do they have similar side effects?
Well, my feeling is that Lupron is the most. It's got the market share. However, we're in the U.S. I do know that over in England, for example, they use Triptorelin, another GnRH analog. I'm not really on top of many things any longer because of my own health problems. But several years ago, when I did do a good deal of research, that seemed to be the distinction, that over in Europe it was Triptorelin, and over in the States it was Lupron. And one of the problems for me is the most common Lupron that I saw being used, you know, in the different guidelines given out, was Lupron Depot 3.75 milligrams. There is no approval for transgender use, so therefore it's being used off-label, and they're using the 3.75 Lupron that was approved for endometriosis. And that is, I think, a problem, because there have been issues raised about the clinical trial data being manipulated and basically frauded up.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But first, I have a fundamental question.
Sure.
It's used for IVF, which is supposed to increase your chance of getting pregnant. But it's also used for puberty suppression, which will stop a girl from starting menstruation. So are those not contradictory effects?
Well, you would think so. In IVF, it's usually used short term, although depending upon the clinic and how they want to run things, at least in the past, during my time, you could be on Lupron for several months. So that's not exactly short term, as opposed to like two to 3 weeks. But in the 2 to 3 weeks, you supposedly would not have the severe suppression that you would have from long-term use. However, just even saying Lupron being used in IVF, there should be red flags raised all over the place, because Lupron is a pregnancy category X drug, which means it should not be given to any woman who is or who may become pregnant, and it is a hazardous drug, according to NIH and OSHA.
Oh, wait a minute. You need to repeat that slowly for me. So you're saying that Lupron is a drug in a category that should not be given to women who might become pregnant, yet it's given to women for IVF treatment who are trying to get pregnant.
You said it.
Okay.
That's a head-scratcher, huh?
Yes, that is a head-scratcher. You also...
It's also listed as a reproductive and developmental toxicant, according to Scorecard, which is a California-based drug review.
And that implies that if you do get pregnant, you could end up with a developmental abnormality with your child.
Yes, and there have been reports of a number of them. I mean, I can speak personally of just people who have contacted me. Some, it was inadvertent, you know, they were pregnant, did not realize it, took Lupron, or vice versa, attempted to become pregnant with Lupron, and their baby has a number of problems. And seizure disorder is one problem in several babies that I am aware of, and muscle tone problems. Eating problems.
It sounds incredibly dangerous to be using it for IVF. I mean, if I knew what you just told me, and, you know, my wife was trying to get pregnant and having difficulties, I'm not sure I'd want to try this.
Well, they may not tell you that it's a pregnancy category drug or it's a hazardous drug, because, just as you said, your wife would not want to try it. So women are not told this. And that's a very serious thing. And what's even more alarming is, it's one thing if they're giving the daily Lupron during IVF, But I've also found quite a number of studies that have used the depot Lupron. Sometimes it's 3.75, sometimes it's a halved dose. But nonetheless, that depot is allegedly in your system for at least 30 days, and the ex-president of Lupron's manufacturer has been quoted in medical literature as saying that detectable levels of Lupron have been found up to 11 days after the last, after it should be out of your system. So 30, roughly, days plus 11. So if you implant an egg on day one, that egg, fertilized embryo, is going to be exposed to Lupron for over a month. That is not a good thing.
No.
I remember the Atlantic Journal Monthly had an article years ago that said that Lupron embryos were different. They grew faster and were more fragile, and no one knew what it meant for the health of the baby or the mother.
One of the things I saw on your website was that if women are handling this as, say, a nurse in an office where they're doing IVF or whatever, they need to wear two pairs of chemo gloves when they're
right.
handling Lupron?
That's NIH guidelines for the handling of a hazardous drug. And Lupron, as well as triptorelin and all of the GnRH analogs, are classified as a hazardous drug. And I came across, after all these years, it was just about 2 years ago, that someone said that their nurse was gloved. They didn't say anything about a gown. Well, I mean, the very MSDS, which is kind of like the gold sheet for any institution that holds that drug.
The safety data sheets.
Right, material data safety data. Mm-hmm. It says right on it, in terms of a spill, you are to evacuate. And how you clean it up is specified. So I just don't understand how, if Lupron is leaked or spilled, you have to evacuate and wear a respirator, chemical safety goggles, rubber boots, heavy rubber gloves. But on the other hand, it's okay to inject it into kids.
Well,
or humans. Any humans.
This is sadly not the only time. The first drug used for AIDS was called AZT, and if you bought it for lab use, it said toxic by inhalation and ingestion, and it had a skull and crossbones on it. But if you got it as a patient, that information was removed. And but I wanted to comment on a couple of things, like my impression of how people perceive pharmaceutical drugs and medicine is that a pharmaceutical drug is very specific. But when you inject a drug into the blood system, or if you swallow a drug, doesn't really matter how you get exposed to it, it's going to go through many parts of your system. It's not going to be limited to the one target organ. And then the second observation I'd make, which I think people don't understand, is, you know, if you need a sufficient amount of the drug to have an effect for, say, 24 hours or 30 days or whatever it is, then a subtherapeutic dose is still going to be in your system for some time after. Like, the drugs don't just disappear on day 30. Like, that's an absurd notion, right? Like, it's... And
there's metabolites that may last longer than the drug itself, depending upon the drug. And I did find one study in which one of the metabolites of Lupron was increasing. I think this was like on day 20, 25 or so. And the study didn't extend beyond that, but it was clear to me that there was a metabolite that was not decreasing and instead was increasing. And that's not a good sign. And the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, they'll tell you this is a one-month depot, but you're not necessarily guaranteed a uniform dissolution of that compound. You know, you might have a bolus on one day and not as much as you're supposed to get for a couple of days. And there's been some feeling that some illnesses may have come about from, you know, sort of a malfunctioning microsphere. You know, they.
Right. I mean, and besides, every person is different. So,
right.
And once you've been injected for 30 days, like, you're stuck, right? Like, you can't get it out.
Yes, absolutely.
One of the things you mentioned quite a bit is a review by a Dr. Redwine. So can you describe what this review is and what it found?
He was contracted as a medical expert for Karen Klein's lawsuit back in the, I think it was maybe 2004. My years may not be right on. But as a result of that trial, he had access to the raw clinical data for the endometriosis clinical trials.
Right.
And he spent hundreds and hundreds of hours reviewing thousands and thousands of pages of raw data, and he found problems. And as he put it, one of the most alarming reviews was in study, it was titled M84-1984-042. In that study, he calculated that 62.5% of the women after 1 year of stopping Lupron had not returned to baseline ovarian function. That's pretty serious. That indicates ovarian damage, and that kind of jives with the anecdotal reports of women experiencing infertility, subfertility, hormonal problems post-Lupron.
And I assume that a lot of women, I mean, not every woman with endometriosis wants to get pregnant, but I assume that some of them are still interested in getting pregnant. And so this is pretty devastating if it's maybe adding side effects to your life, and then you find out that now you can't get pregnant.
Right. And women are not told this beforehand, of course, because the label says that the low estrogen, the hypoestrogenism, will be gone once the drug is discontinued. So what the label says, what the drug company says, is quite different from the data that Dr. Redwine reviewed. He submitted a 300-plus page report to the FDA detailing all of his findings. He did that in, I believe, 2011. And they answered him in 2013, and he provided me their response, and it is up on my website. Basically, there's their risk-benefit ratio was unchanged, and they're not going to do anything. No mention of the fraudulent data.
Here's a quote from Dr. Redwine. "Inclusion of patients with a poor response to GnRHA therapy has not always occurred in outcome analysis in the published literature."
Yes. I let out a scream in a very quiet hospital library when I came across that statement back in the mid-90s. He was my hero from that point on. I did not know him at the time. I sent a letter, an open letter, again on my website, to the FDA in March of 2014. Almost 6 years later, just this weekend, I received a response. I've only looked at a couple of dozen pages, but let me just tell you this. The FDA starts right off at addressing Dr. Redwine's allegations, and they cite the 9 studies that Redwine reviews. They list 8 of them. One of them is censored, redacted. The redacted study is the one that I just said to you, M84-042, in which 62.5% of the women failed to return to baseline ovarian function.
Right.
So my question to the FDA back in 2014 was specifically about M84-042, and it looks like I've waited 6 years for nothing, because from what it seems, they've redacted everything about that study.
I'm confused about why the FDA would redact information about a study.
They say it's proprietary, but the drug's formula is public knowledge. What is proprietary about the drug?
Well, how convenient. So if I'm a drug company and I run a study that has a really bad result, and then I claim that it's proprietary, I can get the FDA to not talk to the public about it?
Well, better than that, if you run a study and it has bad results, you just never publish it and nobody ever knows. You do another one and maybe juggle the results or get better results and bring that one forward.
Well, yeah, I'm familiar with that trick. I recently interviewed Dr. Peter Gotchi, who that's one of his big things, is making sure that meta-analysis include all the data, not just what's published.
Right.
Because the FDA is often privy to data that never gets published in the literature.
Right. All trials campaign absolutely needs to be public. It's a disgrace what has happened.
You also talked about an Amy Dozeret study on prostate cancer. Can you describe what that found?
My memory is just basically that she did a review, and her determination was that if it had come up today, it would not be approved because of the number of deaths, really. The waitful watching was wound up having better survival rates than the drug. That study actually goes back a ways, so my memory isn't
right
on top.
I actually interviewed Dr. Ablin, who discovered the PSA test, who is one of the biggest critics of prostate cancer detection and treatment. Nothing to do with the use of Lupron or other similar drugs, but he's basically saying that prostate cancer detection and treatment is a disaster that is destroying the lives of a lot of older men, making
with
them
inaccurate results at times.
With what?
Inaccurate results at times.
Yes, well, one of his points is that the surgery is so devastating that many men become impotent and incontinent after the surgery. And so their golden years of traveling with their wife and things like that, all of a sudden they're wearing diapers, they don't feel like a man anymore because they can't have sex with their wife, and those are just two of the common side effects, and that's not including taking drugs like Lupron that have their own side effects.
And the men that I've heard from, I have not heard from a whole lot of men in comparison to women, but they clearly have had their lives devastated. Multiple health problems, memory problems, guys that have had to stop working, they have not had an easy time of it either.
I understand. So how does a drug with such a track record stay on the market for, I think, 40 years now?
Well, I guess if you don't address the areas that are problematic, and you have opinion leaders who just pump good information and you pay lots of money. I mean, Dr. Redwine was one who came forward to admit that TAP had offered him $100,000 to put all of his patients on Lupron, and he refused.
What's the name of the organization? You said TAP or PAP?
Yes, TAP, Takeda Abbott Pharmaceuticals. They were the joint venture between Abbott and Takeda Chemical Industries of Japan that made Lupron. And TAP was a manufacturer up until they dissolved in 2008.
And isn't Lupron off patent? So doesn't that mean that that drug companies would lose interest in it?
Well, there are lots of generic versions.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's still quite popular. I don't know the figures off the top of my head anymore, but I used to keep track of their annual revenues, and it's definitely been a moneymaker, for sure, even off patent.
And with gender dysphoria, they have this massive new market, a rapidly expanding market, particularly of girls, teenage girls, who become convinced that they're actually a boy and want to stop puberty. and these young people are going to be experiencing side effects potentially for the rest of their lives.
Right. You know, when I think of all the women with endometriosis, fibroids, IVF, egg donors, surrogates, men with prostate cancer, irritable bowel syndrome, all of the men, women, and children now grown who have contacted me, precocious puberty, I just don't understand how anybody can assume that the transgender population will be any different.
Well, it's being sold as safe and reversible, and I think, you know, parents are being pushed by society. You have to affirm your child. The doctors are saying, here, we've got this safe treatment. Give your child some time to make up their mind. And it seems to all be a big lie.
The most egregious, I feel, is when they discuss the mental health issues, that the depression, the anxiety, your child could commit suicide if they don't get Lupron. I mean, basically that blunt. To save your child, you need to give them Lupron. When, in fact, Lupron causes depression, suicidal ideation, suicide. So it is a complete lie.
And most, well, maybe not most, but I think that's probably true. Most children with gender dysphoria have other psychological problems, such as anorexia, ADHD, autism, things like that, depression, those are quite common. And so adding a drug that has such a powerful effect on the neurological system seems dangerous at the very least.
Right. I mean, criminal. You do see people today who are discussing this as it's criminal. It's abusive. I think it's clearly experimentation. Which I have felt all along on any gender, any age, but especially a young adolescent going through puberty at a volatile time to begin with, to inject a drug that really affects your mind and your whole body, I just cannot imagine myself having gone through that during puberty.
I think it comes back to how the medical system is portrayed in the popular media, that it's portrayed as safe and effective, that drugs are portrayed as very specific, that everything about the medical system is portrayed as definite and good. And the reality is a lot more murky than that. And I think a lot of people get trapped into that. They're sold this drug, whether it's for endometriosis or gender dysphoria, or it's either said or implied that there's not really any downside to it. So why would you refuse to take it?
Right. And people go to their physician seeking help and advice. And they don't generally question, especially if they have a trusting relationship with the physician or the referring physician. And people, unfortunately, don't always distrust and do their own research.
Well, people say you should go to a doctor you trust, and I think that you should never trust a doctor because a doctor is giving you advice. So no matter what the doctor says, you don't necessarily need to get a second opinion, but you should look it up. You can get scientific papers online and see how accurate is the information you're getting, especially if you're taking something that could be irreversible or you're taking something for a long time. And I think hardly anybody does that.
No, and they absolutely need to. And unfortunately, I found out personally the hard way.
Yes.
And have all of the other victims.
I don't fault people, but I think, you know, if our society is going to get healthier, people need to be a lot more skeptical about the medical system.
And not just the medical system, but our guardians, such as the FDA, something I just came across in the report that they sent me after 6 years was they mentioned that Dr. Redwine had been involved in the Klein case. And in a footnote, they just state that, you know, the Klein case went to the jury and the jury found for the defendant drug company and that it went to the appeals court and the appellate found for the drug company. But either the FDA does not know because they haven't looked any further than what's in front of them, or they don't want anybody else to know. But the fact of the matter is, in the Klein jury, Abbott's expert hired medical gun lied to the jury. He said that it is absolutely impossible for Lupron to affect the thyroid gland. So the jury believed this medical expert, and they ruled in favor of the drug company. If only that jury would have been able to do a PubMed search, because there were already numerous articles stating Lupron's adverse effects on the thyroid gland.
And why didn't the plaintiff bring that forward?
Because the plaintiff was prevented from doing so. It was unbelievable. Unfortunately, my website is a mess. I feel very bad in many ways because it's not very well organized, but there is information on my lawsuit page, sort of bottom left, detailing all of this. It was an utter disgrace. There must have been some type of shenanigans going on, because there is no way that what took place in that trial was just. It was absolutely slanted so much in favor of the drug company, and everything that the plaintiff's attorney tried to introduce was prevented, including they wanted me as a witness, and that was denied, along with numerous other things.
It certainly seems like a biased judge, at the very least.
Biased.
Have there been any legal cases that have found against the drug companies?
No.
No. And so
they've all been settled with secrecy agreements.
Ah, okay, so there have been settlements.
There have been lots of settlements. I do have a list of some of the cases on my lawsuit page. And currently, I am only aware of one case in the courts, and that is Terry Paulson's case. She's still in there, but I don't know of any others. And I can tell you that back when the Klein trial was going on, there were lawyers throughout this country that were just poised, waiting for a plaintiff verdict, and then they would go marching forward with their cases, and it would have likely have been a mass tort. But Abbott successfully slammed that door shut, and everything
right.
went away, dried up. And very difficult for people. You don't know how many people write. They need doctors, they need lawyers, and the situation is really incredible and pitiful. There's no medical legal advocacy for Lupron victims. And unfortunately, I feel that the transgender population, because of the political lobby that exists behind them, when they get sick, I have a feeling there's going to be a lot more noise made than the previous victims have been able to raise. You know, back in the 90s, even women were talking about marching on D.C. We tried to have plans to do that, march on Abbott, protest at Abbott's headquarters. And then again in the early 2000s, it came up again. But everybody is just too sick, and we don't
right.
have a lobby. You know, the Endometriosis Association gets all kinds of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, from the GNRH analog manufacturers. So you can't really say that's a lobby. And,
okay. We're running close to the end of our time. Is there anything positive? Because I'm so depressed by hearing about this. I feel for so many women and some men with the prostate cancer who've been harmed by this, and it seems like there's not going to be any justice anytime soon. Is there any bright light out there?
In a word, no. I haven't seen any.
Except
I've been at this since like the early 90s, and I just would never have imagined that it would be 2020, and things are not only unchanged, but the drug has been exponentiated the way it has. And I just would like people to do their research beforehand, because once it's in their body, it's too late, and there isn't anything that can be done that I'm aware of.
Well, if there is a bright spot, it is your website, and as you say, it is there's a lot of stuff on your website, and you know, you're doing it yourself, so it's not done professionally. But what is your website so people can go there and do their own research?
LupronVictimsHub.com, HUB.
LupronVictimsHub.com. I'll also put it in the show notes.
And I guess I could say, for me, the one positive thing is a file that I have from women who have thanked me because before they took Lupron, they found my website and they refused the drug. I do treasure those because I do feel that those women have had their lives saved.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
However, it's such a small file relative to all of the horrendous, agonizing, anguishing notes from people whose lives are ruined.
Well, if I can try to make you feel better, I would say that most people who go to a website like yours and go and get a wake up, like, oh my God, like, I don't think I want to take this drug, most people probably wouldn't think about sending you a message. So there's probably a lot more women out there whose lives have been saved.
I hope so. I was very disappointed last night searching. I came across a Reddit website. It actually was in my statistical program for my website. Somebody had come in. And a woman was saying, I'm so freaked out about Lupron, and she listed two websites, one of them being mine. The responder was, there is nothing, you cannot validate any of that information. None of that information, nothing in the pages you've listed is verifiable. And my website is nothing but medical documentation.
It sounds like somebody with a conflict of interest.
Yes. I'm a drug rep.
I would just like to thank you for joining me today, and I'd also like to thank you for all the work you've done on behalf of the many victims of Lupron and trying to bring this to light. I think it's very important.
Thank you very much for having me and for your interest in trying to expose this. It really needs a major spotlight, so I very much appreciate it.
Thank you, and goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
After we talked, Lynn contacted me again, apologizing for forgetting a couple of important points. Something she blamed on forgetfulness that developed after starting Lupron. First of all, she now has to use a cane due to mobility problems, and sometimes has severe joint pain that she described as like a blowtorch. When she was a child, she was praised for her excellent posture, but 2 years after starting Lupron, she had an x-ray that already showed curvature of the spine. She also forgot to mention that after she took Lupron, she started having tachycardia, fast heartbeat. But that has gradually changed to brachycardia, a heartbeat that now sometimes goes under 40 beats per minute. She also has gastroparesis and has been hospitalized 65 times since retiring in 2003. Thank you for listening to episode 239 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount to Infectious Myth on patreon.com or liberapay.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.